We're ready.
I'm Thomas Wade Boer, born August 13th, 1928.
And what was your address when you, at that time?
Highway Avenue.
Which is
Route
called,
2.
Which is called 18th now.
Which is called 18th Street now, yes.
At that time it was outside the city limits.
Yes.
As you grew up, you started to Willow School.
Willow School. What? 6 years, 7 years at Willow School.
What did you think of Willow School?
That's great. Just right.
What were some of the games that you played when you were going to Willow School?
Baseball, kickball, tag, swings.
Hide and seek?
Hide and seek.
Black man?
Oh, yeah.
Is there anything particular that happened while you were going to Willow School that you'd like to share with us? Incidents or fun you had?
Just loved recess and playing sports, and that's about the size of it.
Well, what did your family do for entertainment when you were...
Listen to the radio.
What were some of the programs that you listened to?
Amos and Andy and I Love a Mystery and The Shadow Knows.
The Creaking Door?
Creaking Door. Those things that you could get on the radio.
And you had to walk from where you lived across the tracks down to Willow School.
Yep.
By where is now the new Safeway store.
Yes.
Then when you went into junior high up at the high school, what did you think about going from a small school up to with all the kids in town coming together?
It was quite a change. It split up the old gang at Willow, and it was different, but we got by. We made it.
What were the things that you liked about high school? What were some of the courses that you liked?
I took agriculture and went into the FFA classes. I liked English. I wasn't crazy about math, but I should have been. But I went mostly to the four years in the ag courses to high school.
What were some of the activities you did in high school?
Well, sports mostly. Baseball, or not baseball, we didn't have baseball then, but we had football, basketball. Last couple of years we had wrestling.
Was there any particular position you played on football, or?
Yeah, I was a tackle.
Oh. do you feel that you got an adequate education at the high school to prepare you for work?
Yes, and if I didn't, it was my fault. There's times when I wished I had better, but then it was adequate.
What would your father do for an occupation?
He was a yard engineer on the railroad.
And what is a yard engineer?
Well, at that time, a yard engineer just worked in the yard limits in the yard for LeGrand, Huntington, and Reith at that time.
And LeGrand had a great big roundhouse.
Oh, they had a big roundhouse.
This being a division point between Reith and Huntington to the east.
Yes, they rebuilt engines, serviced engines. Back in the back shop, they'd tear the engines completely down and rebuild them, the boiler up, all in the roundhouse. The rip track was a huge rip track, and they rebuilt cars and serviced cars, and they had switch engines around the clock. Every train came into town was switched. New engine put on, a new caboose put on, and cars all switched around. Went up the branch or came off the branch to go on the train and so forth.
And the branch that was up to Joseph.
branch was from LeGrand through Elton to Joseph, yes.
Uh-huh. Now, when you were going to high school, what kind of jobs did you have?
Mostly just summer jobs, working on the farms around out in the valley.
And when the war started, you still working on
still
the farms?
Worked. Then I went over to Athena and worked in the peas every summer.
And a lot of kids from LeGrand did that because there were a lot of men gone to the service, and you had to do essentially men's work.
Yeah, we did.
Did you buy a car?
Not till I was probably a junior in high school.
And what was your first car?
1938 Chevy.
And you liked to hunt and fish?
Oh, loved
that
to
time.
Hunt and fish.
Probably never missed a hunting season.
Never missed a hunting season.
When did you get your first deer now?
My first deer was when I was 14 years old. My first elk was probably 2 years later when I was about 16.
Everybody loved to hunt.
Oh, everybody loved to hunt.
Besides that, it put meat on the table.
Yes, that's besides. We lived on about 5 acre. We called it a farm. It's just a little 5 acre acreage. We had cow, calf, and sometimes a pig. Raised their own garden, potatoes and carrots and apples and all kinds of garden stuff. But deer meat and elk meat in the fall helped get the family by. We never went hungry, like some people I knew at that time.
And your wages were pretty low.
Wages were terribly low.
You graduated from high school in 1947.
Yes.
And what did you want to be?
Well, I really wanted to go into education and coach football. But I never even got close.
Well, you worked for the State Forest Service for a while.
As soon as I graduated from high school, I went to work for the Union Pacific in the B&B department the summer after I graduated. Dick Hamilton, a friend of mine, him and I worked in the B&B department at Bridge and Building. And we worked there till September. Middle of September when college started, and I went 2 terms to college and run out of money and went back to work for the railroad and the water service department that took care of all the water pipes and heat. We rebuilt the In 47, we relined the powerhouse from coal so they could put fire brick in it so they could burn oil. And that was 1947. And in 1947, the first diesel freight locomotive came through town. And we was all standing on the platform watching it come in, and it was something I never even envisioned, and it didn't look anything like I had thought it would look like. It just looked like a streamliner passenger engine, but of course it wasn't.
Well, when did you decide you wanted to be a railroad engineer?
Well, when I couldn't find a job anywhere else. I worked, got married in August of 1950, and I worked for the mill, and I worked for Gippo Mills around the valley, and worked for farmers, and worked in the service station, and worked for Mount Emily a while. Like you say, I worked for the forestry department, and in 1953, February or March, I got a chance to hire out as what they call call boys at that time. They were clerks, waymasters, and I worked there until June of 53, and I transferred into the fireman on the railroad. And I've been there, was there 37 years.
And when you changed over there, that established your date working for the railroad that all railroaders worked by.
Yep.
And,
7/25/53 was my hiring out date as a fireman. And I worked 13 years as a fireman at Hinkle and LeGrand and Pendleton and Huntington. Hosslin at Hinkle and LeGrand and Huntington, and in the yard at Hinkle and LeGrand and Huntington. In the fall of the winter of 54, I was cut off for about 2 months, and the winter of 55, I was cut off 2 months, and then they went to from a 7-day work week to a 5-day work week, and that put a lot of us back on, and from that date on, I was never cut off as far as not working. I was cut off of the extra board, which was the premier job in most cases, because you could work all as much as you wanted. And then I'd have to go back two different winters. I went to Huntington to fire in the yard. And then I wasn't cut back anymore.
And all those years you worked different times of the day and night and never could depend on a holiday at home.
That's very true. Unless you was on a assigned yard job, why, you worked any hour of the day and night. Any weekend or holiday they wanted you to do.
When you first started as a fireman, how did the engineers treat the fireman? Was there a little hazing or?
No, there were some engineers who were just plain mean, and others could care less, and then there was a good many of them that liked you and enjoyed your time and you spent with them and was enjoyable to work with. But there were some that wasn't that way.
Well, there was a lot more to running an engine than just pulling the throttle. What were the things that you had to worry about and learn so that you became a good engineer?
Well, that'll take a long time to explain that. But yes, well, there was a lot, a very, very strict rules and orders and regulations that you had to know. And you had to know them by heart, and many has heard the expression, you did things by the seat of your pants, and that's one place where you felt the train by the seat of your pants, or just the way you topped over the hill and set your brakes, and just the way you felt at the situation, and if it didn't feel right, you adjusted it. If you adjusted it right, why, everything worked out fine. And if you misjudged it, then you had a little problems getting down the hill or up the hill. Down the hill is the worst. Most anyone can run up the hill. It's when you top over and get everything gathered up and go down that hill. And it's not straight down or straight up. There's flat places, and especially on the east end where you can't use your brakes all the way down, you have to release them and gather them up, do it all over again. Same way on the west, you top over Camila and set your brakes, you get down through Meacham, you got to release them. And then when you get over the west end of Meacham, then you really got to put them back on, because that's steep, much steeper than going from Camila down, and it's longer.
Well, was the this division, the Union Pacific, one of the steepest grades?
Yes, we have a 2.2 grade on both east and west out of LeGrand, up and down. This is where the 90% of the helpers were used, and it was a short run because of the mountain. the average speed or the maximum speed on the mountain was 20, 25 miles an hour until you got down on the flat by Gibbon, and then you could release them and go track speed from there to Hinkle.
And what was track speed?
Well, it varied according to straight track or curved track. You had speed restrictions on curves that you had to abide by, and speed restrictions through towns. East End, when you had speed restriction down the hill, and when you got down to Durkee, well, you could go up to 25 to 30 miles an hour down through Burnt River Canyon. You could get out of Huntington, then you could go about as fast as the engine could pull it.
Well, as an engineer, did you have to know how much weight you had in the train? And
It helped you in your mind to know what the tonnage was in the train, whether you could make adjustments to know when to set the brakes to slow down for curves. You had, they said, a quarter of a mile to a half a mile before curves, you had the speed board. It tells you what that curve was good for and what the maximum speed of your train was good for. And it didn't take you long to realize and learn that that speed board, if you waited to that speed board to set your air to slow down, you was too late. You had to do it. You looked down the track and know where you was at, or knew where that speed board was, and you set the air accordingly. Like you going out of La Grande eastbound, as soon as you got your head end over what we call the Pepsi-Cola crossing at the east end of La Grande, you could go as fast as your train was ordered to go till you got to the curve at Hot Lake, and then you had to go around that at a reduced speed, and you had to go the east end of Union Junction was a very restrictive curve, and you had to approach that at reduced speed, and then from then on, the way up the hill from then on, you was at that speed because you couldn't go any faster.
You got this information from the dispatcher?
No, you had a timetable that you lived by, mm-hmm. and that told you what your speeds were. These speed boards had to mark on them freight, passenger, and streamliner. The streamliner was on the top, the speed the streamliner could go, and the next numbers was the speed a passenger train could go, and the next numbers, the bottom numbers, was the speed a freight train could go. And a person could become an engineer a lot quicker than 13 years, but we had an extreme amount of firemen. Every train, every engine had a fireman at that time. And it wasn't until about 64, 65 that they started doing away with the fireman jobs. And yard engineers had firemen, and they started doing away with those jobs. When I was a yard engineer, I didn't have a fireman most of the time. And most of my railroading days, I didn't have a fireman unless I was teaching one, giving one instruction to how to become an engineer. And we did that. That's how they were taught how to become an engineer, is they worked with another engineer, or many engineers for that matter, but they worked with an engineer, and what he did rubbed off onto them, hopefully the good points. Some of them picked up some bad points, but then.
When you were an engineer that was running a helper, how did you hook up with the train, and then did the other engineers set the pace, or how did you communicate back and forth?
Well, before we had radios, the head end of the train, head engineer on the train, could set the pace. Of course, you knew what the rules were. You would watch your gauges, the speedometer, and when he started setting there, and your gauges would show that you were putting more power into it because he was slowing down, then you would throttle down accordingly. You had gauges that would show like 100, 200, 300 amps, 400, 600 amps on your gauge. When they would go up extremely high, then you'd throttle down. Watch your air gauges so you could tell when he was sitting there.
It became much easier later when you got radios to communicate back and forth.
But you generally knew what the length of train was, how far up ahead he was setting, and you knew when he would set air that he was either going to go in at hill guard or going up the hill. You didn't worry too much about it, except when he'd set a good amount of air to slow down to go into hill guard or camille or so on. Out on the flat, you watched it, and if he set a lot of air and the speed of your train was coming down, you knew he was approaching, let's say, Haines, well, you would throttle down accordingly because your speed into the passing tracks was 20 miles an hour over the switch, and then immediately when you got into that passing track, you'd come under a different rule that anything in that track was visible opposition to you, you had to stop short of it.
Later on, when they had a number of units in a train, it could all be controlled by the front end engineer.
Yes, they came through with what they called slave train, slave units, and they would hook them in by radio to the train. You controlled it from the head end by the gauges on. You had another box that set on your stand that told you what those units back there were doing, and you could also set the throttle what they were doing and worked it accordingly to what you were doing. Sometimes you might work them a little harder to keep the slack up, or when you were in dynamic braking, electric braking going downhill, you worked those in dynamic braking also.
Is that the thing that they call dynamiting the train?
No.
What was that?
Dynamiting the train is going to emergency. Mm-hmm. But dynamic braking is on a diesel electric locomotive is when you take it out of your controls, out of power, go into dynamic braking, and it reverses the current from the traction motors, makes them into an electric generator, and makes versus the current, and throws the current back up through dynamic grids and burns it off into the atmosphere, the current off into the atmosphere. So each wheel on a locomotive has a traction motor. So that diesel engine in that locomotive, all that does is turn a generator that makes electrical power that turns that traction motor and allows the engine to move one way or another, and it can run backwards the same speed as it can run forward. And then when you top over the hill or want to go to dynamic braking, you take it off of power and put it into a dynamic brake, and it makes the generator out of that traction motor. It makes it just like shifting down on a pickup or car going downhill. Makes
well, a car you'd call it compression.
A car you'd call it compression. The engine you call it dynamic braking.
You told me sometimes one of the worst worries for an engineer was to see somebody along the tracks and afraid you were going to hit them, and there was nothing you could do about stopping within how far?
Absolutely. If you got a train moving any speed at all, you go to emergency. That locks all the wheels in the train, And that train on an average would go the length of itself before it could come to a stop. So when you see anyone on the side of the track or a car going across the crossing, there's nothing you can do. You can go to emergency, but you're still going to hit them. And I went out the branch with an engine and three cars and hit a car out there on a crossing between LeGrand and Island City and go to emergency, and we still went through beyond the crossing, the engine and three cars.
Uh-huh. So. You told me one time over in Idaho, there was a grandfather and a little boy there, and you were so upset, and it's hard on an engineer to see something like that and know there's nothing he could do.
Yeah. Fortunate enough, I wasn't on the train that hit the little boy, but then they were, that incident, they were fishing off the Snake River Bridge in Ontario. Nothing you can do. They can't outrun that train off of that bridge. I've never seen anyone able to do that. And you just, people in LeGrand especially talk about too many whistleblowing for crossings. But all they have to do is get on that engine and ride it for a day, and they'll see what stupid people do around railroads tracks, and I don't think they would ever complain again, because all that engineer is doing is telling you, I'm coming to a crossing, or if he sees anything along that track, there's this prescribed whistle that he has to blow according to the law of the state and the government and the railroad. It's a long, two shorts and a long. And that tells you to get the crap out of the way, because I'm coming. There's nothing I can do about it.
Wish more people would pay attention.
Yes, unfortunately I have hit cars and I've hit people. And like you say, that's the most sickening feeling that there ever was to hit an individual or a car, and there is not a thing you can do about it. You can't go out of the, you can't swerve, and you can't stop until that train's ready. You know, you go to emergency, and that train will go till it's ready to stop, and then it'll stop.
Well, often now with some of these trains as long as 100 cars, they're a mile long, aren't they?
Oh, there are, most trains out here now are a mile long, sometimes a mile and a half to 2 miles long.
It's longer than I thought.
Oh, yes.
During the time you were working for the railroad there, you had a little time to help in the community. You were on the school board. Can you tell us a little bit about when you were on the school board?
Yeah. Served on the school board for a year, I think it was 1969, and then I filled a vacancy for a guy, and there was a year elapsed, and then I went back on the board for a 5-year term, and I just did my best, did what I thought was the community and the children more or less, more than anything else, needed. I could approve. I was on the board at the time we had a bond raising to make an addition to the high school and build a new middle school and build a new Island City grade school on the same bond levy. And I was proud to be a part of that.
Also, you had a son and a daughter that went to school here.
I had a son that went to school and graduated. Daughter went to school here in high school, all through school in LeGrand and high school, and graduated. Both went on to college. The boy graduated 3 degrees from Eastern Oregon. The daughter went a couple of years and then quit and went to work. Still lives in the community.
And during that time you were an elk in the Elks Lodge, and also became a mason and eventually a Shriner.
Yes, I did.
You were very active in the Shrine football.
Very active in this. I put in 12 years as a West team manager for the East-West Shrine football game. We played some in a few years in Pendleton, and the rest since then had been in Baker, Oregon.
It's a very rewarding...
Much. I've been through that Shrine Hospital, well, I know 12 times. We'd meet the boys in Portland and take them to the Shrine Hospital and load them on buses and bring them to La Grande. We spent 2 weeks with them every summer. Now I think they only spend 10 days.
And when they go to the Shrine Hospital, none of them came out with a dry eye.
I've never seen a human go into that hospital and come out with a dry eye. Even after being in it 10 or 12 times myself, why I can't come out with a dry eye. But it's not from the pitiful action of the children. It's just I've never seen a child unhappy or cry. Yes, like I say, I've been through there numerous times, and the children are always glad to see you. Want you to put your name on their cast, or they're very, very appreciative that everything that the ball players do for them, and that the Shriners do for them. And the Shriners Hospital does not charge one penny for any care of a child in those hospitals, and I think that's tremendous. I think there's 23 hospitals throughout the United States, plus I think 3 Burns institutions that the Shriners Hospital and their doctors, both in the Burns portion and in the children's portion, teach lots of other doctors how to handle bones patients. And I think it's improved a lot of burn conditions, treatments for burn children that they've learned from the Burns institutions. And they're always, I want to say, they're always striving, testing to do better, make better conditions, treat the children better.
You've been a part of the Shrine Caravan.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit how that works.
Yeah, I was in the food caravan, we call it, for about 10 or 12 years. It starts in Fruitland, Idaho, in the wee hours of the morning, and comes through Ontario, Baker, La Grande, and Pendleton. People, Shriners particularly in the community, these communities all the way from Fruitland to Portland, throughout the fall of the year, gather food, substance, non-perishables, some perishables, because they can go down in one day and get put into a freezing unit. And I've been where there's been 30, 40 vehicles in a line that end up at the Shriners Hospital in Portland with thousands and thousands of dollars worth of food stuffs for the Shriners Hospital, which they use. There's some cases, if they have a tremendous amount of perishables, they have a deal with one of the other children's hospitals in Portland, like Dornbecker, that they will exchange, give them food for non-perishable foods and so on, so nothing is wasted.
Well then, as you went along, when you retired from the railroad, you became very active in the Elks and the Christmas baskets.
Very active in the Elks. This is 13 years of working on the Christmas baskets. We gather money and foodstuffs in the fall and go out to different stores and purchase turkeys or now we, for the last few years, we purchase a gift certificate where the person can use it instead of for meat, instead of giving them a turkey. And that's very rewarding. We, when I first started on the Christmas baskets, I think we did 50 or 60, and now we're up to 100, 107, 105. Sometimes we've even done 109, but that's really crowding this room, the space we have to work in.
We also make up candy in sacks with an apple and orange and candy.
Yes, we
buy. How many are you doing now?
We buy candy and apples and oranges and peanuts. And the last few years, we've made up 130 candy sacks for children and for the Elks Christmas parties, and then just to give to children. And we make up 150 what we call diabetic sacks for the nursing homes and the hospital. And those consist of quite a bit of candy. The diabetics, we buy diabetic candy for that. And we have give them an apple and an orange and a big handful of peanuts.
And this is a tradition that happened even when you were a child and lined up and got your sack of candy.
Yeah, I can remember taking my children down to the Elks and get their Christmas candy sack, and it was a much bigger event then than it is now. They had the Christmas tree in the corner, in the middle of the intersection at Depot and Washington, and they would just block off that intersection, candy passing out time, and the children would line up for blocks to go get their sack of candy. Now we only do, like I say, 130, and we have to look up children to give it to them. They don't seem to come around and pick it up anymore. Yeah.
What do you think about how the Grand's gone, having lived here all your life?
Basically, the Grand hasn't changed as much as people like to think it's changed. I always loved the Grand. It's a small community. I used to think I knew everybody in town, and now I don't even know two people on the street. As I recall, when I was a kid growing up, there was about 8,000 people in the community, and now we're up to, 13,000. But a lot of that is on account of the city limits have changed more than influx of people. The downtown has changed to the point that there isn't as many merchants downtown as there were when I was growing up. And that's sad because that's a lot of communication. I visited with lots of people and lots of merchants that I knew back then. And you don't stop in town, and very few places in town that you go to anymore. There used to be a Montgomery Ward's and a Sears, and of course a J.C. Penney's has been there as long as I can remember. You had a shoe store down in the same block as M.J. Goss, and you had three clothing stores for men, several for women, and you just don't have them. The banks bought out and changed a lot of the way the town looks. I think one of the saddest things that ever happened in my lifetime is when they sold the Sacagawea Hotel, and it was torn down and made into a bank. That was one of the cornerstones of the community, was that Sacagawea Hotel. They said it was rickety and going to fall down, and I laughed when they tore it down. They had a caterpillar up on the fourth floor. And I don't think that if it was a rickety old building, they'd have been able to put a small cat up on the fourth floor to help knock down the building.
They tore it down floor by floor.
Yep, they did.
In those times, we had the Zuber Hall for
yep.
dancing. A lot of the young people went there.
Yeah, you had the Zuber Hall. You had Payless up on Main Street. And the National Guard used to practice and meet before the war, before the Second World War, upstairs over the Payless.
Payless was, this was the very first store in the Payless chain.
Yes, it was. First store in the Payless chain, and now there isn't any Payless anymore.
They changed it to Rite Aid.
Yep.
How many of your friends were around that went to high school with you? Did they find occupations here, or did they have to move?
Most of them moved. There was a handful that stayed, and some that came back after they got in retirement age. By and large, the majority of the graduates from LeGrand High School had to go somewhere else to find employment. I was fortunate enough to find it on the railroad. There was a few out of our class that went to the railroad, but not very many. But the railroad and the mill was the employment hub of LeGrand.
Do you think the farming's changed a lot since when you were young?
What?
The farming's changed a lot?
Absolutely. I can. First job I ever had, I worked for Crossing, Ray Crossing. He lived out there below that Grandview Cemetery, the first farm on the Foothill Road. And I got $2 a day. And we put up hay. I drove the team. I rode my bicycle from my home out there every morning. They fed me lunch. And we'd put up, just him and I, we'd put up the hay. And then I'd ride my bicycle home. Then I got a job out by Hot Lake, and I went out there and stayed on that farm and got $2 a day in my room and board. And then when that harvest season came, my dad came out and told me that I could go over to Athena and work for my uncle in the harvest. And I think I got $8 a day for that job. And I was a header puncher, what they call a header puncher, a thrashing machine, a combine pulled by a big caterpillar, I think, or the header was 20 foot long, 24 foot long, and my job was to lift that up and down according to the height of the wheat so that you didn't get too much chaff and make sure you got all the heads of the wheat into the combine. And that was a turning point. From then on, I went to Athena every summer and worked in the peas and stay right through to the wheat harvest, come home before school and go to school. When spring was over or here and school was out, back to Athena I'd go.
Mostly that was during the war.
During the war.
But,
all during the war.
What did the war do? Changes in the community that you remember?
Well, I really don't know that the war, it changed everyone. I can't dream that things would have, I'm sure they would have been different, but what difference it would have been. It made us all grow up faster.
More responsible?
More responsible, and of course we were, as graduates from high school in 1947, we were quite upset because as we recall down through the years and watching all the things you could, tapes and things you could get out of Oregon, Oregon State, and the bigger colleges, why that was the first couple of years of college was supposed to be fun and easy and big times had by all. But when we got into college, all the veterans was coming back from the wars and wanting an education, and they set the standards higher than what we had anticipated, and it was a little rougher that way.
Mm-hmm. We did have the air cadets living in the Sacagawea Hotel.
Oh, yeah.
Going to Eastern College during
the war.
The war. And then taking flying out at the local airport.
The airport, and they graduated, went to a ground school, a flying school in Texas, and then they came back, most of them came back to Pendleton. Pendleton and Walla Walla was an air base for the military, for the Air Force during the war. And one thing I do remember that the boys that went over Tokyo for General Doolittle trained Pendleton and Walla Walla. Mm-hmm. Before the, of course, this wasn't the only place they went, but they did, the ones that went, trained at Pendleton and Walla Walla.
Well, there was a shortage of men around the community because of the war.
Yeah. It was all off
and that's
war.
Why you had to grow up and do things to take their place.
Yeah, the college was, I think the biggest change in the community has been the college. Because back then, if they had 400 students, they was counting the janitors. I can remember in high school football and basketball, we used to play the college. Just a scrimmage, but we played the college. When we went to high school, 2/3 of our graduating class went to Eastern Oregon. And I think Eastern at that time was about 700 students. That neighborhood, now they got quite a few thousand students, 3,000 I believe is the last I heard, 3,000 or 4,000 students. The campus is a lot bigger than it was. They used to play in the old Quinn Coliseum. The neighborhood kids and I used to sneak into Quinn Coliseum and play basketball when nobody was supposed to be around. We had ways we could sneak into the gymnasium, dressing rooms and into the gymnasium.
Well, one good thing that came about, both the college and the high school used the same athletic field, which
yes,
is a good thing.
Back when we were in school, we played at what is now the middle school soccer field. That was a premier football field in Eastern Oregon. It was much better than Pendleton's or Baker. And the college played their games there, what teams they could muster up during the war and right after the war, and they played their games there. And when the college progressed, they built an athletic field down east of Quinn Coliseum, which was as far as I'm concerned here. Here around LeGrand, if you build a field, a football field, you want it to run north and south with your bleachers on the west side because the wind comes down Deal Canyon fiercely. The field that the college built down there east of Quinn Coliseum by the cemetery was the field laid east and west. And a lot of people didn't know it, but one end of the field was about 6 foot lower than the other end of the field. And it did make a difference on which quarter you played, which end of the field you was on. It was easier to run downhill than it was uphill. But they finally got their act together and built them a nice stadium there south of Quinn Coliseum. And it's a very nice stadium. a nice track, and sometime you want to go look at their baseball diamond. That was a joke of the whole league, because they call it Snowflake Field, but you look at it and your home plate's uphill from second base or anywhere else in the field.
Was there anything you'd change?
That I would change?
Yeah, that you, when you were growing up, that you'd do different? How do you feel about it?
I really don't think that, looking back on it, I thought I had as good a life and growing up, and yes, there are things I would have changed. I didn't think I needed all this sophisticated education in the high school. I took what required of me for English. Was tickled to death to get out of that, but I would encourage anyone to get all the English they can get and all the math they can get, because you don't think it on the farm or on the railroad you need it, but you work with figures and you need the ability to express yourself, and especially in this day and age. And I found it very early after graduating from high school that I needed it then. Fortunate enough, there were things that I did and organizations that I belonged to that I did learn how to express myself. Sometimes I get a little upset and make too big an expression of myself, but then...
Well, when you were a fireman and engineer, there were times when things happened to other employees that you were able to go to the officials and work things out?
Oh yes, I worked back then. You had what they do now. Back then we had three union organizations on the railroad. We had a fireman's organization, and you had an engineer's organization, and you had a trainman's organization. I started right off involved with the fireman's organization and was the mileage man for at least 10 to 12 years. And when I went into the engineers, I took over the same job and was what they called then the local chairman. And I did represent different employees in the engine service that got either in trouble or called up on the carpet by the company and have to have what they called an investigation, supposedly to try to find out the truth of what happened. And be sure of the time it was a one-way street that the company thought it was the individual person's fault. But I was involved with that until I retired.
Well, that went along with Gould's car, that everybody had tested. How often was it?
Every 2 years.
And any infraction, you got demerits?
You got demerits or time off, what they call discharge. They'd never fire you permanently unless you did something very, very gross. But we had to take a very strict rules examination. We had to take three examinations: mechanical, air brakes, and rules. And they were from 300 to a couple of thousand questions on each. You had to take it orally and in a class discussion, and then written. And you had to be perfect. In other words, oral, you couldn't just him all around and guess at the question. He knew the answer when he asked you the question, and you better give him the answer back the way it was in the book. When you did it written, it had to be letter perfect and with the punctuation marks in the proper place. I's dotted and the T's crossed. I never had that kind of that much of a problem, but I do know guys that got marked down for not having their punctuation in the right place. We take three firemen in at a time. Each class would have three in it, and it'd take all day. Each time, you didn't do it all at one time. You'd take the mechanical, and then so many months later, you'd take the air, and after that, you'd so many months later, you'd take the rules. And after you got those all completed and got your card, and then you was an engineer. But you didn't get a date on the board until you went out, or someone below you went out on a trip as an engineer. Then you got the date.
And all railroaders carried job insurance because
all railroaders carried job insurance.
Pull you off for most any infraction.
Yep.
And decide who was it. Fault, and then
and you couldn't live with unemployment, so you'd carry job insurance enough to most men carried enough job insurance that you dislike working day, and you made that much a day, didn't lose any money.
But overall, the job gave you a good job, enough to earn a living and buy your own home and have a car and raise your family and
very good job
and a good retirement.
Very good retirement. Back then, it was fun to go to work. I enjoyed going to work. They used to have the call boys, crew callers here in LeGrand. The dispatchers was here in LeGrand. Most of the time, lots of times, the guys that was waiting to get called throughout the day would go down to the depot and go into the call boy's room to check the board to see where they stood or where their turn stood or where they stood on the extra board. And there was always three or four, half a dozen guys in there, and you'd visit with them. Then when they moved the dispatchers to Portland and the call boys to Portland, all you were a number on a telephone. They'd call you by telephone, and you'd take your calls by telephone and go to work, and then there was someone there to hand you, give you the orders and what train you were taking and so on. They took the personality out of the job. But then, a few years, they moved the call boys and the dispatchers to Salt Lake City. And it was the same as in Portland. You were just on the telephone. And now, before I retired, they went to Omaha. And everything is run out of Omaha by computer. More than anything else, you don't. They learn your voice and who you are, of course, but they don't know you by sight. And when you were here in LeGrand, all you had between you and the call boy was a window pane. You could see them, talk to them, visit with them, joke with them. They were neighbors. They lived in the community where you live. They knew you or knew of your family. I knew all the call boys, some personally and others by reputation. When they went to Portland and Salt Lake and Omaha, no, you didn't know them. You knew the sound of their voice. It's a lot easier to tell a guy you can't lay off over the telephone than it is 3 foot away looking through a glass window. That was always our contention. We didn't like it, but that's the way it is. Now you can miss calls if you're not on the, if you're not home. Back then, if you wasn't home, they had to come to the house, or if you didn't answer your phone, they had to come to the house and call you. Some men didn't have phones for that reason. They wanted them to come out and call them. When they moved to Portland, Salt Lake, and Omaha, then you had to have a phone, and everything was done over the telephone.
You usually have an hour from the time that you're called to go to work.
You had an hour to an hour and a half. Most of the time it was an hour and a half to get prepared to be down there, ready to go out on that train at that hour and a half. They always had the crews called in such a way that they would be there waiting for the train to come in, instead of the train sitting there waiting for the crew to show up.
Did you ever work up the branch?
Worked up the branch both as a fireman and as a signed engineer. And the branch is a good run. I loved to work on the branch. It wasn't like the main line. It was slow, and the scenery was horrendous. You could see all kinds of game and wild animals and activities on the branch. It was an all-day job. We'd take 10 or 12 hours going up and come home at 6 or 8. And we'd always run faster coming home than we did going up. But, yeah, I liked that job. Lots of people liked that job. And then when they moved the crew started going to, from Huntington, we went from LeGrand to Napa in 73. Now that was the premier job. You got more time at home by working that job because it was 180 miles from LeGrand to Napa, and it's only 106 from LeGrand to Hinkle. So you could go make it a round trip from LeGrand to Napa and get 2 to 3 days off when you got in before your turn worked up to go back out again. I liked it very much. One of the prettiest scenes you ever see in your life was coming from Napa to LeGrand, and you top over Telecasset and come down through Crooks and around Piles Canyon to where you could come around the turn into the valley the first time you see.